Okay, we'll get going. So thank you all for coming here tonight to hear our latest speaker, who I'll introduce now in a moment. But I suppose a word or two about the background to the talk. It's actually particularly topical. You may have seen in the Irish Times 2 days ago an article claiming that aggressive secularism is a myth and an invention of Christians, that there's no such thing, that by definition aggressive secularism can't exist. And the article actually, ironically, was so aggressive in tone, so sneering, so dismissive and so contemptuous towards Christianity, that it proved the existence of the very thing it was setting out to disprove. And the essential message of the article, apart from the mockery, was Christians know your place. And you see, I suppose, in a sense, what we're confronting increasingly in Ireland, and so far in Britain to a greater extent, is a claim that Christians need, and religious believers generally, need to know their place. And our place is not in the public square. And our place is to have no influence over the laws of the land, and increasingly not even to have any place in terms of the identity of the countries in which we live, and that our historical identities, even if Christian, are to be abandoned in the name of inclusion and multiculturalism and so on. And it is assumed that the most inclusive ideology is secularism, that it is the one that guarantees that everybody has their fair place and rightful place within the public arena. So it's with that in mind that I thought no better person to invite over to address these sort of topics than Bishop Michael Nazarelli. And it's particularly good in Ireland to get the point of view of somebody from outside the Catholic, the Roman Catholic fold, I guess, to show that this is not simply just a Catholic issue. It's an issue facing all Christians and indeed all religious believers. And Bishop Michael Nazarelli is a particularly articulate voice in terms of asserting the rights of religious believers, producing a very articulate critique of aspects of multiculturalism and, of course, of aggressive secularism too, and in the British context, because part and parcel of multiculturalism is, the rise of, I suppose, radical Islam or Islamism. Now, that's obviously much less of a presence in Ireland, but is a rather major presence in Britain. So the name and title of his upcoming book, which I think is to be published in September, and it's also the title of his talk tonight, is Triple Jeopardy: Aggressive Secularism, Radical Islam, and Multiculturalism. So just to give a bit of background about Bishop Nazarelli, he's originally from Pakistan, and it's the first diocesan bishop in the Church of England. It says in the biography, non-white. Is that correct? That's what it said on the official website anyway. He was appointed in 1994. Prior to that, he was bishop, and I'm sure I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Raywind in Pakistan. He holds both British and Pakistani citizenship, and from 1999 was a member of the House of Lords, where he was active in a number of areas of national and international concern. He is both a Christian and a Muslim family background. Bishop Nazarelli has been a visiting lecturer in a number of universities and colleges in the UK, Canada, the USA and Australia. He has travelled widely in Africa, Asia, Australia, Europe, North and South America. He is the author of 10 books and numerous articles on mission, ecumenism, Christology, the Anglican Communion and relations with other faiths. And in fact, after the talk and during the tea break, or rather during tea afterwards, you'll be able to see a number of his books there on the top table if you're interested then in sort of buying them on the internet. And you'll also see a copy of a UK magazine called Standpoint, in which he has produced an article that's an extremely good defence of the public doctrine of marriage, because, of course, marriage has been currently debated in the UK, and Bishop Nazarelli is a defender of the traditional universal understanding of marriage, and produced a very good defence of it. And so just to draw your attention to that as well. So without further ado, I'll hand you over to Bishop Nazarelli, and we'll have plenty of time for questions afterwards. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed for that generous introduction. I'm sure I don't deserve it. And it's very good to be here this evening and to meet some old friends. We were just talking about Father Liam, and as we were talking about him, he walked into the room. And I mean, that's always a great, great thing when that happens. I see also that the average age of this audience has been radically reduced by our youngest member. Is he still here? But welcome to him or her, and to him, his or her mother. Oh, well, there you are. See, responsive as well. Excellent. We have had a number of crises. You wouldn't know anything about that, of course, in Britain. So we had a financial crisis. We are still in the middle of it, where the financial institutions in which we had put our trust, we discovered were not worthy of that trust. And just as people were recovering from that shock, we discovered that the politicians to whom we had given a mandate to govern us had their hands in the till. Of course, you wouldn't know anything about that at all, would you? I mean, Irish politicians, I'm sure, are honest, all of them. And then we had public disorder in our streets. Very serious, and these riots, as they were called, were unprecedented, really, in the cities in Britain. Now, when these crises occur, politicians come up with sort of balmy words, don't they? They come up with words like tolerance or mutual respect or sometimes opportunity. And they are what I have called thin values. That is to say, they cannot bear the weight that politicians very often put on them. And so when we are confronted with these thin values, naturally we ask ourselves, are there other values that might better bear the weight of what is confronting us? And so I want to say a little bit about that and the challenges then to those values from the directions that David has mentioned. In Britain, certainly, as you look at how the nation came to be, I'm always amazed at how a kind of medley of warring tribes, petty kingdoms, fiefdoms, came to be a united nation, a country with a definable identity. Now, how did that happen? Well, it happened mainly because of the work of Christian missionaries, both from the north, coming in with the inspiration of Iona itself, of course, and, of course, also because of the Roman mission with Augustine's arrival in Canterbury, and then his missionaries came to Rochester, which is very welcome. The work of his successors, Theodore of Tarsus and Hadrian the African, in establishing the parish system and the first system of education and of social security. The nation, not only in its origins but in its development, as I hope we shall see, had everything to do with the Christian faith and indeed the Christian church as it brought the Christian faith to the land. Ireland, of course, has an earlier story, and I'm always very interested in hearing your story and the place of the Christian faith in that. But if we think of Britain for the time being, and Britain is here typical of many other European nations after the decline and the destruction of the Western Roman Empire. If we think of Britain as becoming a nation in this way, what characterized it? I mean, what what could we say characterized this nation in its earlier stages and indeed as it developed? Now, Maurice Cowling, who is a Cambridge historian, has distinguished between what he calls the descending themes of nationhood in Britain. By these he means, for instance, the influence of the Christian doctrine of God. God, the Holy Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, where there is both a mutuality of love, but also order, so that the Son is not the Father, and the Holy Spirit is neither Father nor Son. Now, that was hugely influential in the way the nation expressed its life, as I shall show in a moment. The influence of the Pauline teaching of the godly magistrate, the godly ruler, evoked again and again by the English kings to sometimes justifiably and sometimes unjustifiably to defend what they were doing. And of course, the huge influence of the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue. You can remove the Ten Commandments from courtrooms, as they're busily doing in the United States at the moment, but you cannot remove their influence from the development of Western jurisprudence, generally. Now, having said all of that, what this resulted in is what Joan O'Donovan has called a society in which a matrix of divine, natural, and human law produced a situation where there was priority given to mutual responsibility to people of all classes and of all estates, as they used to say, a feeling that they had a responsibility for the whole of society and for others in it. In the prayers for the Parliament in Britain, this sense of mutual responsibility is still evoked, actually, because the prayers date, of course, from those days. This is very different, if you think about it, from the way in which people now emphasize their rights over and against society, rather than having a sense of responsibility for society as a whole. So this was what Cowling called the descending theme. That is how society was organized by main principles having to do with what Christians believed about God, what they believed about their social duty, and what they believed about their rulers. I mean, the accountability of the ruler, of the kings, was an important theme in all of this. But Cowling then says that in addition to this descending theme, as it were, that came down from above, there was also an ascending theme. And this had to do, particularly in the medieval period, and this was Europe-wide, of course, with a greater recognition of the significance of the human person. I'm told, there are Aquinas experts here, so far be it from me to say anything about this definitively, but I am told that this had to do with the recovery of Aristotle by Europe, which of course happened, as you know, through the Muslims first receiving Aristotle back and then transmitting Greek learning, and particularly Aristotle transmitting that back to Europe. Of course, what is not always said in this context, in Western universities you quite often hear that Europe received Greek learning back from the Muslim Arabs. I mean, that's perfectly true. What is not often asked is, how did the Muslims get it? And of course, the answer is they got it almost entirely through the work of Eastern Christian clergy belonging to different denominations, the Melkites, the Jacobites, and Nestorians, and so on. But that's another story. That's not my subject tonight, you'll be glad to know. However, the reading of the Bible in the light of Aristotle, or perhaps the reading of Aristotle in the light of the Bible, I don't know which, led to this greater appreciation of the human person in respect, first of all, of human agency. That human beings really are agents in this world who can make a difference, even if a limited difference to the world. Secondly, as to human freedom, that human beings are really free in this world, even if in a limited way. I mean, we are not absolutely free, of course, but we do have a certain amount of freedom which we can exercise in the world. And this gave rise to a greater appreciation of conscience, that if human beings are agents and if they are free, then the human conscience has to be formed. And of course, the claim was that it was the church that formed this conscience. Along with the greater significance of conscience, there also arose the idea that if the human person is so significant, then this person must have some say in how he or she is governed. So not only conscience, but consent about how we are to be governed arose. And I watched a BBC program on Magna Carta recently. And you would have thought that Magna Carta was a purely secular development brought about by enlightened thinkers. Well, this is completely anachronistic, because Magna Carta was inspired by a Christian view of the human person, and therefore the safeguarding of that person, led, of course, by the church, but with many other people participating. Rochester Castle was held by Stephen Langton, Archbishop of Canterbury, against King John for months, I think it may even have been years, to make sure that John did not get rid of Magna Carta. So conscience and consent. Now, this view of the dignity and the freedom and the agency of the human person received a new currency, as it were, if you like, when Europe came into contact with what is called the New World. I see that there are several eminent Dominicans here, and I'm sure they will say something about this, but the debate that arose in the universities in Europe, but also, of course, on the field in the Americas itself, was what rights did the native people have to property, to mobility, to family life? And there were many people, both in the Americas and in European universities, who wanted to deny them any rights whatever. To say that, to take in fact the Aristotelian position that some people are naturally born to slavery. That was a very convenient doctrine after the conquest, and many people wanted to believe it. But against that stood the Dominicans. I think this has to be said. The name of Bishop Bartolome Las Casas comes to mind, who strongly defended the fundamental freedoms of the, what were then called the Indian people of the Americas, in terms of property, in terms of mobility, in terms of family life. And in this, he was influenced by work, again, at the Dominican-dominated University of Salamanca, Francisco de Vitoria, and others. This language about natural rights, first developed in this overtly Christian context. It was only later that it was acquired by the Enlightenment, for example, by John Locke. Locke is an interesting example, because whilst his writings defend natural rights, as he had learnt about them, in fact his property interests in North America led him to act in a way that was quite contrary to the doctrine of the natural rights of the indigenous peoples. This story, as it were, continues with the what you might call the moderate enlightenment. I mentioned Locke already. And when we speak of the Enlightenment, we must think of those people in the Enlightenment who were seeking to build on a Christian consensus. There was another kind of Enlightenment, of course, that ended up with the French Revolution and what happened. We all know about that. But at the same time, as this moderate Enlightenment was seeking to articulate its views about natural rights, there occurred in England anyway what we call the Evangelical Revival. And these evangelicals were people who were reading their Bible and deriving their view about the human condition from the Bible. So the opposition to the slave trade and later to slavery itself arose because these evangelicals, the Clapham sect, people like Wilberforce, realized that you could not preach the gospel of freedom to people and enslave them at the same time. So that is why the great descriptions of Africans as brothers first arose. The evangelicals were not just concerned about the slave trade, they were also concerned about the terrible working conditions that people experienced in the mines and the factories in England itself. Women, children, men, children who never saw daylight because they were pulling wagons in the mines. And so the first pieces of industrial legislation in Britain were sponsored by these evangelicals. And many other things can be said about them. They were supporters, for instance, it's worth noting, they were supporters of Catholic emancipation. Now, because of their views on freedom, not because they agreed with the Roman Catholic Church. The revival of nursing as a profession in Britain took place first under Roman Catholic inspiration from the continent, and secondly, because of evangelical action. Now, what all of this did was to put in place what I have called an Enlightenment evangelical consensus in Britain, anyway, which lasted right up to the 1950s. So the evangelicals were using language that the Enlightenment thinkers had also used, and as I was saying, the Enlightenment thinkers in turn were indebted to Christian thought about natural rights. So what happened then? I mean, why are we in the situation in which we find ourselves? And there are two theories, at least two theories about it. You may have more. One is, of course, the long, drawn-out, withdrawing roar of the sea of faith idea, that secularization took a long time and was a drawn-out process. And if you want to read a book about it, Owen Chadwick's The Secularization of the European Mind is actually a very fine book to read about how it happened. If you take this long drawn out withdrawing roar of the sea of faith idea, there are certain things to note in it. Of course, the development of the sciences had also taken place under Christian inspiration. I mean, that has been demonstrated very interestingly, most recently by James Hannam in his book God's Philosophers. However, scientific method had concentrated more and more on the whatness of things, you know, what things are, identifying and classifying, and that, of course, Adam had done already in Genesis chapter 2. It had also concentrated on how things work. You know, this is the way of the empirical sciences. But what was neglected had to do with the why of the things and of persons. Why does anything exist? Why are there human persons? And also the what for question. the strictly speaking, the teleological question: what are things for? What are human beings for? What is human society for? What am I here for? Secondly, because science develops by rejecting earlier theories in favor of later ones, tradition as the wellspring for thought atrophied. So it was thought less and less important to turn to an intellectual or a spiritual or a moral tradition because scientific method, as it also influenced other disciplines, tended to be innovative. And that is why today you get politicians and others talking about modernization as a virtue in itself. So there is no need to turn to the past because we have already replaced what there was. And then thirdly, there was what you might call a flattening or a disenchanting, if you like, of both time and space. You see, our idea of time comes from the Bible. I mean, the Bible's view of time is absolutely unique in the religions of the world. So Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, to some extent, have this view of time. But it is not found in the ancient religions, and it's not found in other world religions where, generally speaking, there is a cyclical view of time. But the Bible's view of time as an open, progressive movement is quite unique. And that is what has made science possible, for example. That is what has made our views of development possible, and so on. But whilst the Christian Church had this view of time, it also provided for people to be taken out of mundane, ordinary, workaday time periodically, with the great feasts and the fasts of the Christian year. What secularization did was to turn time into just chronology, into pure succession. And Charles Taylor has written very well about it. You may want to read him if you have the time. I mean, he does take a lot of pages to say what I've just said. I mean, I think this is illustrated very graphically by what happened to a single word. Do you know the word I have in mind? Yeah? Go on. Which word? No, it's Holy Day, actually. In a Holy Day, what was Holy Day? A Holy Day was a feast or perhaps a fast. But what did Holy Day become? Holiday. So it was completely disenchanted, if you like. And similarly, space was disenchanted. So no particular space, no particular place had any more significance than any other. In the medieval world, the Holy Land was the fifth gospel because you had to go to the Holy Land to understand the other four gospels. But now, no space, no place, no shrine, no church was of any more significance than any other place. So this is the long drawn out view of secularization, if you like. There is another view which I think deserves attention, and it is best put in Callum Brown's book. I don't know if people have come across it. It's called The Death of Christian Britain. And there he has a sudden death theory that the public importance of Christianity in Britain died suddenly. It was not the result so much of a long drawn out process. He says, I relate this for what it's worth, he says that Christianity ceased to be of public importance in Britain when it ceased being passed on in the home. His theory is that the faith was never really passed on in churches or in schools, but it was actually passed on in the home. And he goes further, I mean, he's himself an agnostic, of course, but he goes further, he says it was passed on by the mother. And it's when mothers stop passing on the faith that Christianity ceased to be of public importance. Well, I think there's something in it. Changing role of women. Today, in the Queen's speech, the government has announced that it will make more money available to make mothers go back to employment earlier after the birth of their children. Well, you'd think that put money into mothers going back to work later, but that's not how it is. So the changing role of women has certainly shaped this. I think there are other influences and factors which are leading to the kind of secularism that we are finding. So in the 60s, which is where Brown locates the death of Christianity in Britain, the writings of certain kinds of neo-Marxists were hugely influential. Marcuse, Gramsci, Lukács, and the idea in these neo-Marxists was that you had to confront and destroy bourgeois institutions so that the political revolution could come. Of course, the family was the leading one of these, so no surprise there. The judiciary, the church, parliamentary democracy, all of these things were targeted. But the assault on the family has been unprecedented because it was regarded as the steward of bourgeois values. The political revolution, at least in Western Europe, never came, of course. But the social revolution that these people were sponsoring did come. And for some people in Britain anyway, it became not a means to an end, but an end in itself. So the London School of Economics, I'm sure you were thinking, when am I going to mention LSE? Anthony Giddens, who used to sit behind me in the House of Lords, began to talk about free relationships. What are free relationships? Free relationships are relationships that last only as long as those who enter them want them to last. And then they can give them up and do something else. In Britain, our planners are actually now acting on the assumption that people will have transient relationships. And so housing has to be provided in such a way that takes account of such transient relationships. So you're not building family homes, but homes for people who may be in a relationship today and another one tomorrow, alone the day after, and so on. These free relationships, by definition, do not need what the Archbishop of Canterbury called in his days when he was a radical theologian, socio-religious sanction. That is to say, marriage is out. You know, marriage is just a bourgeois way of oppressing and enslaving people, particularly women. Now, the result of all of this, certainly in Britain, has been a moral and spiritual vacuum. And I mean, I have to say that the church has been entirely complicit in creating this vacuum. You may say, why shouldn't there be this sort of vacuum? What are the dangers? What are the implications? Well, first of all, this vacuum has created exactly the sort of situation I was describing in the crises that we were confronting. Fatherless children. I mean, one of the things that was clearly identified about the riots was that many of these young men and women did not have very much parenting at all. And in particular, the absence of the father was crucial in their maturing and in their developing. The incredible pressure on single parents, usually mothers, of course, to go out to work. So you've got no father, the mother is at work, how are the children being brought up? Secondly, the moral and spiritual vacuum has allowed and will allow in the future the rise of extremist ideologies to take the place of the Christian consensus. I mean, that's the great danger. This is why I think radical Islamism is something that I need to mention, particularly in the British context, but Europe more widely. This is the first time since the demise of Marxism that Europe and indeed the world is facing a fully organized, comprehensive political, economic, and social ideology. I mean, radical Islamism is not just a religion, it's not just a faith. We can deal with our Muslim brothers and friends in their devotion and their piety at one level, and that's absolutely fine and good, and I do it all the time. But radical Islamism is an ideology. And what spiritual or moral resources does Europe have now, having abandoned Christianity, to confront such an ideology? That's the question. Now, if that is the situation, what do we do about it? Some people certainly do not want to see the return of any kind of Christian consensus at all. This is quite clear. They have organized their lives on the basis of the absence of the influence of Christianity of any kind. And they would be seriously inconvenienced if Christianity put in an appearance again. And yet, how are decisions to be made? In Parliament, we are again and again presented with bills that have moral implications, whether it is about the status of the human embryo. I'm glad to say that in Britain, even now, although much eroded, the special status of the human embryo is recognized in legislation. I gather from David that is not so in Ireland. But why should the human embryo not be treated like any other human tissue? Why should it have special status? You know, you need a moral and spiritual tradition to tell you why it should have a special status. And this is true over many things, as we shall see in a moment. In the absence of a moral and spiritual tradition, what is happening is that politicians are relying more and more on opinion polls and focus groups and what I call the yuck factor. You know, the yuck factor is what the public will not take. And then, of course, you work on the public, and lo and behold, in 5 years' time, the public, after all, is able to take it. You know, how many things you can think of where that has happened. All the classic declarations, from the Declaration of Independence in the US, the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights, the European Convention, all speak of the inalienable dignity of the human person, don't they? I mean, that's the sort of phrase. But on what is that inalienable dignity based? Why should we believe that the human child over there has as much inalienable dignity as anyone else here? Or the person being treated for mental illness, or person who is nearing the end of their earthly life, that they have the same dignity as anyone else. Why should we believe that? There was some years ago a bill going through Parliament in Britain on mental capacity. The government had first called it the Mental Incapacity Bill. But then they realized this was somewhat infelicitous. And so they changed it to the Mental Capacity Bill. And the question was, does a human being at any stage lose mental capacity to such an extent that inalienable dignity does not anymore attach to them? And there was a sort of informal discussion about this in one of the committee rooms. And I was there, and an eminent philosopher in Britain who's had a huge influence on legislation in Britain in the last 30 years She said, well, you probably know who I mean now. She said, but of course, dignity can never be taken away from a human person. So I then asked her, I said, well, why do you say that? And she said, well, she said, it's because of the Judeo-Christian idea that we are all in God's image. And she is known as an agnostic. So I said, well, I believe that. I'm very glad to hear that you do too. But what it showed me was that in certain situations, even in the legislative process, transcendent ideas or principles have to be invoked. Have to be invoked. Whether it is life at its earliest stages or at the later stages on questions of how to treat the human embryo, or on matters of assisted suicide or voluntary euthanasia or whatever it may be, or in cases like mental capacity, you have to go beyond the purely utilitarian arguments. So human dignity is based, has arisen from the Christian view that we are all made in God's image. What about equality? You know, some years ago they set up the Equality Commission in Britain. I don't know if you've got a similar thing here. No doubt you have. Anyway, I received an invitation from them to come and address them. I was very surprised by this, and I said to my secretary, I think they've got the wrong bishop. and, you know, would you mind checking? So she checked, and she said, no, Bishop, it's you. So I went, and I found large numbers of people beavering away at equality. You know, there's a huge equality industry in Britain anyway. And that's great. But of course they don't know why human beings are equal. On the face of it, human beings are not equal. You know, the Olympics are going to be held in London in a few weeks, and we shall find out what incredible physical prowess some people have. I mean, I certainly could never hope to have it. People are differently mentally endowed. All sorts of inequalities of wealth and status. Why do we believe human beings are equal? And in the end, it has to do, doesn't it, with the Bible's idea of common origin. The common origin of human beings. I used to be at one time the head of our mission agency called the Church Mission Society. I think Liam may remember it when I was. I used to read what missionaries did in the past. And one group that I was quite interested in was CMS missionaries in Australia, who would go preaching from one settler town to another in the 19th century. And I picked up at some stage that they were often preaching on this text from the Acts of the Apostles, which in the old translation reads something like, out of one blood hath he made all the nations of men. And quite often they were run out from these settler towns for preaching this, because of course the settlers did not want to believe that they were of the same blood as the aboriginals. Common origin. Charles Darwin was very embarrassed after the publication of The Origin of the Species that his work was being misused by what I've called scientistic racism. Racist theories in the United States and also in Europe that used evolutionary ideas to show that different races were at different stages of human development and so forth. And Darwin was very embarrassed by this and gave huge amounts of money actually to combat this misuse of his work. But of course, modern science, genetics, has shown that the instinct of the Bible is right about common origin. So both dignity and equality come from Christian ideas. So does liberty. By the way, it's just the non-coercive nature of the gospel. Jesus never compelled anyone to believe in him or in what he taught and what he did. At the time of the Reformation, I mean, one of the big questions was, who should have access to the Word of God? And Tyndale, in his translation of the Bible, had expressed the hope that even the plowboy should be able to read God's Word. Bishop Tom Wright, who was then the Bishop of Durham, was the Anglican fraternal participant at the Roman Synod of Bishops on the Word of God, a couple of years ago, was it? And in which the bishops declared that every Catholic home should have a Bible in it, and all the faithful should read the Bible regularly, and so on. And Tom Wright said in his speech that if this had been said in 1517, there might never have been a Reformation. But liberty arises from this view of the human person as agent, as free, as possessed of conscience. And I was just saying to these radio people that I remember an interview that Pope Benedict did some years ago, where the journalist said to him, for years the Roman Catholic Church has taught that error has no rights. Why have you changed your mind, and why do you now have Dignitatis Humanae, and why is the Catholic Church defending religious freedom? And the Pope gave a very good answer. He said, in this we have gone back to the earliest form of the tradition, which is the teaching of Jesus himself. And I was saying that it is not that the church should modernize, but that in facing the modern world, the church recovers for itself what it needs for this circumstance or that. Now, hospitality is again a Christian virtue, and in the debate about multiculturalism that David mentioned, what happened in Britain anyway was that the British people were faced with a new kind of diversity, ethnic and religious and linguistic, at precisely the time that Britain was losing Christian discourse. You see. So how were they to cope with it? Instead of using Christian ideas of hospitality, of engagement, of friendship, of service, they invented multiculturalism. Multiculturalism is based on amnesia. It is based on the view, you know, we don't know who we are. We certainly don't know who you are. So let us carry on with our lives separately and see how we get on. I mean, it's all done in goodwill. There was no ill will there at all. But again, a very thin basis. And what it did was it produced isolated, segregated communities. It produced people who were not integrated into national life. There was no common language, there was no common view of citizenship, and the isolation and the segregation was taken advantage of by extremist groups, both radical Islamists and the far right. Now, this would not have happened if the whole of the Christian tradition about our common humanity had been brought into play, but of course it wasn't. Now, there are some people, like the former cabinet minister in Britain, who say, well, of course, we have got these values from the Christian faith. But he said, actually, it's like a ladder. Once you've climbed up a ladder, you don't need it. So you can kick it away. Well, I mean, this is a very dangerous thing to say. Because in my experience, as soon as you kick away a ladder, you find you need it again. But is that so? I mean, can these values survive on their own, floating about, as it were, without the grounding in the faith which has given them birth? Or are we living on past capital? Are we living on what is vestigial? You know, the cat has disappeared, and how soon will the smile on its face also disappear? Is the question. Then, of course, there are politicians who say, well, yes, we have got these values from the Christian faith, but all religions produce the same values, don't they? I mean, how often have we heard that? Well, do they? I mean, that's the question I want to put to you. Do all religions produce the same values? Radical Islamism, for example, will always emphasize social solidarity over personal freedom. Always. In fact, not a radical Islamist at all, but a moderate Muslim friend of mine said to me once, he said, Bishop, we never know when you're fasting. So I said, well, you know, Jesus had said that when you fast, people shouldn't know. And even before I'd finished, he said, but in Islam, fasting is a social act. That is why if you go to a Muslim country during Ramadan, you jolly well know that it's Ramadan. Whether you're old or pregnant or ill or whatever, the social reality of the fasting has to be maintained. Hinduism is a very noble system, very elaborate and intellectually very interesting. But Hinduism, of course, has produced the caste system. Now, you cannot expect a worldview that has produced the caste system also to produce a view about human equality. So, in modern India, and Hindu reformers themselves recognize this, that in modern India, ideas about the equality of men and women, for instance, have arisen because of Christian pressure. Buddhism, again, I mean, how many Westerners are in love with Buddhism and the Dalai Lama? But in Buddhism, to believe that there is such a thing as an enduring self is itself deception. In fact, it is the basis of all deception. Okay, that's a very sublime idea, and we can think about it. But a worldview like that is not going to produce inalienable human dignity, is it? So not all religions produce the same values. In fact, the values that we have of service, sacrifice, selflessness that are promoted in public life have been derived from the Gospels and indeed from the person of our Lord himself. Now, aggressive secularism, on the one hand, holds to some of these values that we've been talking about, like human dignity or freedom or equality, but it cannot give any account of them. You see, on the basis of their presuppositions, why should human beings have a dignity that cannot be taken from them, or indeed freedom for that matter? Why should they be thought equal? Why should they be thought free? Secondly, when it is opposed to Christian ideas, it is often because of a radical view of human autonomy. Think about it, whether that is to do with how you treat the human embryo or the fetus, or whether it has to do with assisted suicide. It has to do with a view of human autonomy that Christians can never have because they believe in interdependence of human society. You know, back to that mutual responsibility idea that I was talking about earlier. But aggressive secularism is also very individualistic. because of this view of autonomy, and therefore very often its arguments neglect the common good, what society needs, what particular people in society may need, etc. And then it is libertarian. So there is a tendency to permissiveness. I was for 6 years the chair of the Ethics and Law Committee of the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority in Britain. And I was constantly besieged by libertarian ideas. And of course, the in that area where science is going far ahead of moral thinking, you never catch up, because the libertarians are always asking you to allow the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. It is in thrall to scientific development. So the presumption is that scientific development must be good, whereas of course that is a presumption we cannot make. Now, of course, in addition to aggressive secularism, there is also what you might call procedural secularism. That is a kinder sort of view supported by many church leaders, which holds that there is a kind of secularism that provides a place for everyone around the table. But the thing is that the table is never bare. When people gather, they always gather on the basis of certain presuppositions. And what I've found, in my own experience anyway, with procedural secularism, is that it smuggles in, from the back door, ideas from programmatic or aggressive secularism. And so those who participate on the basis that there is a tabula rasa find actually that there isn't one at all. And that the dominant ideas of aggressive secularism will come eventually, if not immediately, to the fore. There is a choice, I mean, for people in Britain, that may be so in Ireland, there is a choice of whether people are to continue with the Judeo-Christian tradition in terms of the formation of moral and spiritual values, which are necessary for public life. I mean, I'm not now talking about private belief, but necessary for public life, for policy making, for legislation. Will they continue with that or not? This is not necessarily a case of privileging one church or the other. I mean, in England, there are some good arguments for the continuing establishment of the Church of England. There may be some good arguments for the special position of the Catholic Church in Ireland. But even if you say that no church should have any privileged position, that still leaves the question, what moral and spiritual tradition are you going to use in your public life? Just finishing. And aggressive secularism has not produced anything that gives us confidence to say we can use this. In fact, in almost every case where a moral and spiritual background is needed to make these sorts of public decisions, we find that the Judeo-Christian tradition is the surer guide. And it is that we must continue to promote in national life, regardless of what we may think about the place of this church or that in it. So thank you very much for your patience, especially David.